afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 1st, 2012. I'm Arlie Schlanger and I will be your host today. Well, last week in the midst of the most serious global crisis in modern times, the Schiller Institute held a conference near Frankfurt, Germany. There were attendees there from around the world and speakers from all over Europe, from the United States, as well as from several Middle Eastern countries. In her keynote address, Schiller Institute founder and chairman Helga Zepp-LaRouche set the tone for the whole conference. This conference is convened, she said, because we are on the edge of a thermonuclear war. And if mankind is to survive, we must change directions, away from a British-provoked clash of civilizations to a new dialogue among cultures. This was done before, in the middle of the 15th century, at the Council of Florence, under the leadership of Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa. The singular unique role of Cusa had two effects. He provided the impetus for the mission to the New World, which three centuries later was consolidated with the victory of the American Revolution over the British Empire. And secondly, his work in science, which was the key for the launching of the Golden Renaissance, and through the work of Johannes Kepler and others, led to the founding of modern science. And it was these two effects, the development of the American system, as well as modern science, which led to the improved economic conditions that enabled us to have a world today that has almost or more than 7 billion people in it. In the course of the conference, most of the participants came to realize that this is our job today, to create a new renaissance in culture and science, to guide statecraft into a new era of peaceful cooperation and development. Joining me today to discuss this mission of creating a new renaissance are Stefan Tolksdorf and Megan Beetz. Stefan attended the conference in Germany and spoke in the final panel, and he will be speaking to us today from Berlin. Megan has recently been a participant in the weekly LaRouche Pack program, The Weekly Report, which comes on every Wednesday on LaRouchePack.com. And in recent weeks, the report has taken up the task of how to communicate the quality of ideas which are essential if we are to create a new renaissance. So Megan and Stefan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Harley. Glad to be here.
Well, Stefan, I'd like to begin with you. What is it that struck you the most as a participant and a panelist at the conference last weekend?
I think what struck me the most is something that I also said in the closing panel. Many years ago, I first heard this quote from Martin Luther King that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And my personal impression of the entirety of the conference was that we are, I mean, it's so obvious how deep we are in the crisis, at least here. And it's no secret. It's not, you know, esoteric knowledge. Everybody knows that. And so a lot of, you know, what in the past might have appeared as, you know, almost a competition, whether you would, you know, we would present certain development programs, and other people said that they have other ideas. And what I noticed is that it was taken very, very, very seriously, in a different way than conferences in the past. And in that sense, I would agree with Helga's thought. She said at some point after the conference that this was the best conference we ever had. And I'm not sure if she thought that or if someone else said that, but it both makes sense because the participants, the speakers especially, were surprised. The speakers were surprised about the audience was surprised about the speakers, and I think everyone got a live sense of an actual change through the culture panel on Saturday, on the evening of the first day of the conference.
Well, that was my question for you coming in now, that obviously the conference changed the way people looked at both the world as it is, but also the potential for change.
Yes, yeah. And, I mean, some of it has to do, you see, when I started organizing this week, coming back from the conference, I would often just tell people very briefly about the beginning of the conference. I would say we had Helga Zeplerush, the president and founder of the Schiller Institute. We had Mr. Sheikh Attar, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And as far as I know, there is no representation in the United States, so this is probably the most important foreign representation that Iran has. And then Hussein Askari, who presented this beautiful war plan against the deserts of the world. And just by bringing this up, I can tell I had people's attention. It's like you feel the pull on you know, when you're fishing, and all of a sudden something bit, and you have their attention. So part of it is the really the density of analysis, but also ideas, which is very, very important. I can tell you from going to many, many events here in Berlin, there are a lot of people who are really very good at analysis. They analyze all the problems, and they analyze, you know, all the crisis and this aspect of the crisis and that aspect of the crisis, but they never show up with any solution. So when I said that the participants, the guests, were surprised and struck by the speakers, it is because we had, you know, all these many aspects in the conference and you know, people who spoke with a lot of authority because they know what they're talking about. And there was a live discussion. But also for the speakers, you know, sometimes you can tell that they are not used to an audience like the one that we put together, because people are very attentive. I mean, this is a tough program, 12 hours on Saturday or maybe even more. And then on Sunday, we started at 10 and finished at 6. And it was, you know, very little break in between. It was very dense and very packed. But then they are surprised to find an audience that is so attentive. And I think this the musical evening on Saturday night just brought that together on a higher level. And
one of the questions I'd ask you also is that it seems clear to me that this crisis is something which cannot be avoided by people in Germany right now. You have on the one side the collapse of the Euro system, the European Union, the Germans being blamed by the Greeks for the misery and the killing policies that are being implemented there. You have Germany at the center of the Patriot missile deployment to Turkey, which puts the Germans right on the front lines of this new Balkan war scenario. And then on top of that, assuming this is a cold winter, you have Germany looking at a shortage of energy given the shutdown of nuclear power. So how real is this crisis to most people in Germany?
Well, I would say it's frighteningly real. And one of the most difficult things often is in organizing is really to find an opening to actually talk with people because there's a lot of denial because it's so bad, because it's not something that you can look at from a safe distance anymore. It's something, I mean, if you go through supermarkets here, you look at the development of prices, mm-hmm. It hits people. Energy prices went up enormously. I mean, everyone got a letter. Every household got a letter from their electricity or utility company saying that for the following reasons, energy prices will be higher. And yet, at the beginning of the week, the parliament here added another cost to that, which is a real absurdity, because this is you see, when people build these offshore wind parks, and these wind parks are not connected to the electricity grid, which in some cases they aren't, because the grid doesn't exist, the investment is high, and so forth, then the owners of these things will be compensated for the energy that they're producing, which is not being put into the grid. In other words, they can sell something, you know, without ever delivering. And that's being put on top of that increased energy cost anyway.
So it's a non-production cost to each German taxpayer.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's rage about it. But obviously, when you're upset and enraged about something, and that comes at the same time with a feeling of complete inability to change that, people often, you know, I don't know if that's an inner migration, but it's definitely a fear which you have to break through first. You know,
But I assume you got a sense from the effect of the conference, especially the more personal side with the music presentation on Saturday evening and the cultural panel on Sunday, that you could get a sense that you can bring optimism even to people who are facing this crisis and who may be going in and out of denial.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. This is the same. It's very similar to going into other concerts. People first have to realize that when you have a musical presentation, like the ones that we did from Beethoven, but also a very beautiful trio by a composer I had never heard of before, Lachner, it's quieter than you think. You know, at other events or all kinds of music that is being played is often amplified through these gigantic sound amplification systems. This music is actually made by people. There are people singing, there are people playing violins and violas and pianos. It's much, much quieter, and yet it's much more intense. Obviously, I think what we did was only really just a little taste. It wasn't very much. It was a little taste and a peek into a world that people otherwise often either don't know of or can't enter. And there were many tears. And I think, you know, if people are moved, if they realize that they can actually recognize something very beautiful, and in a sense they're part of it, either, you know, as the audience or the singers, that doesn't matter that much in that moment, it changes them. And I think being touched, you know, when you feel that they're, you know, we're not just people who are talking about development plans and what the world should look like. We're actually people who are with their hearts and minds on a mission. And it's very difficult to put that into words. I would like to assemble a chorus here and and just, you know, present that to the audience we have now. That would be beautiful, but maybe technically a bit problematic.
We'll work on it, but I think you did a pretty good job of communicating that. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 1st, 2012. You've just been hearing from Stefan Totsdorf, who will be with us for the whole hour. He was the lead candidate for the Busso in the German and the Berlin elections last year. I think you were running for Bürgermeister, no?
Yes.
The Minister-President of Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll be with us. And now I'd like to turn to Megan Beetz for a moment, because you heard what Stefan just said. Obviously, this is very much along the lines of what you've been working on in the basement and with the presentations on the weekly report. I wonder what your thoughts are from having probably seen some of the panels at the conference and also putting that together with what you've been doing, Megan.
Yeah, well, I think that just to get a larger picture of the thing, the real crisis we're dealing with in civilization is the dominance of the oligarchical system in society. And the population over the past decades and really much longer than that has been brought to a state where the natural impulse of human beings for creativity, for beauty, for the development of the unique capacity of the human species, which is the human mind and the human soul, these things have been so covered up and stepped on and destroyed in civilization that the real crisis we're facing today is really that. And if you look back in the best times of human civilization during, culturally during the times of Mozart and Beethoven and Bach, you see that this was really flourishing and you would have fight for this. So in the recent period, Mr. LaRouche has been putting enormous emphasis on the absolute necessity today for humanity to recover knowledge of the human mind, human ideas, the ability to act to tap in through human creativity in the human mind to the actual solution to the problem, which doesn't seem to exist in the current state. And I think just to concur with Stefan, this sense of surprise that you get from people when they finally get the sense that the programs that we're proposing are possible, even though they seem so outside of the realm of what they see around them with the collapse and so forth. It's that emotion and the ability to actually see what they don't see going on around them as real and fight for those solutions that we absolutely have to develop in the population. So,
well, Megan, I know you've been doing some organizing. Stefan does organizing. And you come up against this problem of both the pessimism and then the ignorance. The natural question that arises, especially, you know, I've spent 30 years now in the South, and in the South, it's very difficult sometimes to carry on a conversation that doesn't include bacon and football in it. So, Megan, of course, you're a Southerner, so you'll know what I'm talking about. But you said something here that I think is provocative for 99% of the population. You said the natural impulse of the human being is creativity, and that this is something Mr. LaRouche is fighting for. How do you see that? How do you know that that's true?
Well, one way I think you see it is in what Stefan referenced, in the absolute joy and emotion that people feel despite themselves to a presentation of a beautiful concert or a beautiful aria or a beautiful poem. And I think we're also seeing it in the response that we're able to draw out of people in the population, where when we fight with them on the streets, that they have to drop the pessimism, they have to drop the defeatism, and they have to actually fight for something beyond their lifetimes, and that they should join us in fighting for the programs that we're proposing, because this would unleash a complete renaissance for civilization. And the fact that we're actually drawing out a response from the population, they want to participate in something beautiful. And I think people are just going to have to really, break from the culture that they see around them and decide that they want to participate in something more beautiful.
Well, we saw something along those lines in, even of all places, the Congress the other day, where you had a hearing on the question of infrastructure and development. And John Garamendi, a Democratic representative from Northern California, and Marcy Kaptur, who our listeners are aware of through her sponsorship of the H.R. 1489, the Bill to Restore Glass-Steagall, had a very profound discussion of what was different about the Founding Fathers. Garamendi referred specifically to Washington and Alexander Hamilton. In her presentation, Kaptur referred to Franklin Roosevelt with the Hoover Dam, Dwight Eisenhower, the space program. Now, the obvious point being that they were reflecting on this potential creativity. Now, we're in there every day. I don't know if you've been going into Washington this week, but tell us a little something about the LaRouche Pact mobilization in Washington to try to see if we could even get a human response from people in the Congress.
Yeah, well, this is actually very exciting. On Monday night, we had an activist conference call, which involved over 50 activists from around the country. And a decision was made that not only would the full-time members and full-time LaRouche PAC associates be mobilizing all across the nation focused on Washington, but we also got our entire activist base mobilized. And we've already had many meetings in Washington this week coming out of our activists mobilizing people in their states and layers that they know to call into Washington to demand that the representatives in the Congress meet with us on Glass-Steagall, on the question of Obama's violations of the Constitution and impeachable crimes, including the most recent cover-up of the Benghazi incident. And so we've had an incredible presence in the conference well into the evening, into receptions and intersecting congressmen at receptions. But we've also been out on the streets, and we've had dozens of LPAC members on the streets with the latest literature and statements from LaRouche directly hitting people early in the morning as they take the trains into work. We've had organizing tables intersecting these people on their lunch breaks and just really stirring things up. And I'm sure things are just going to escalate over the next 2 weeks.
Now, Stefan, to come back to you and what we did with this conference, I interviewed Helga a few weeks ago on the LaRouche Show, and she talked about a new initiative for major economic development that would be broader than just the Middle East, but include Eurasia, Africa. What was presented at the conference that now represents a new potential for this new paradigm?
Well, I think most importantly, it was the presentation that Hussein Askari did, our friend and in Sweden. He's originally from Iraq. I think he's been on the LaRouche Show a number of times.
Yes, he has.
Yes, and so he, well, what we discussed before the conference is that that the program that we have put out about 6 months ago for a development plan for the Mediterranean, Southern Europe, and Africa now is not enough, because the crisis that is building up in Syria, in southeastern Turkey, Lebanon, and in Gaza, and Egypt, all the way to Iran and Pakistan, must be addressed as well. And Mr. Askari made a very, very powerful presentation, because he argued strongly that the side of the empire always says you have to wait. First, we need to create the political conditions, peace, and a political solution to the problems, and then we can talk about development and economic development. And he said, no, it's not true. We need the economic development, and with that, we're going to solve these problems. So he showed a beautiful map that showed the desert areas in the world. And since part of that in the Americas has been taken care of, or hopefully will be taken care of, by NAWAPA, he concentrated on Asia and Africa and presented a number of initiatives that are already happening in the small nations, using a certain technology to fight the desert and to win more arable land. And he just really, he just made it much, 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 much bigger, because obviously a lot of these efforts are rather small scale. They don't involve the use of nuclear power. They don't involve the use, at least not much, of water desalination. And so he presented that as in saying, this is the way that we're going to solve this crisis. So that, that was discussed in various aspects of that. Obviously, we also had two people who talked about aspects of space travel, which, that this intersected a lot, because it's only through satellites, for instance, that we find water resources that are gigantic and entirely untapped that can be used in such programs. So, but besides the actual, that was presented and discussed. Other things were shown. I didn't see it all because I was also doing translating and certain logistical tasks. But the other thing is, we decided, and the participants, the guests, the speakers, very much agreed with that. We decided we're going to turn this into a process. In other words, we have in the works now, and I hope we can sometime soon publish this, a website that is dedicated to that conference, but not as a thing that has happened in the past, and the website will just serve as an archive. But this will be an ongoing process. It will have the presentations that were made at the conference in video form or in written form, because certain things were submitted that we just couldn't present because there was not enough time. Other people are invited to participate in that discussion, to put in their own papers on dealing with the things that we have presented there, which is to change a paradigm. And hopefully, and that's everybody's hope, that will result in a follow-up conference, which will happen sometime next year. It's not entirely clear when, but for two reasons, because with this, also with this conference, we did something we usually do not do, which is it was very short term. So certain people just couldn't come because, they have their own busy schedules and can't fit it in easily. But there was a lot of echo on even the proposal of this conference from people who couldn't come. So we're going to turn this into an ongoing process. And as the discussion showed at the conference, always with the impetus, we're not here to talk about, beautiful projects and then go home and, basically come back together in 6 months and talk about beautiful projects and then go home. The task for everyone, the participants, the guests, the speakers, was to find ways to put these ideas on the agenda in their respective countries, put them into circulation, find who else to talk to in politics, in think tanks, in other institutions that can help make this possible. Because it's actually true. There is not exactly a flood of solutions out there for this crisis. We are really the only ones who present a comprehensive solution to this whole thing. So,
there is an alternative paradigm that's being presented, which is the one of Tony Blair, Obama, the British paradigm, which, you know, ironically, at the same time our conference was going on in Germany, you had the move of the new Egyptian government to change the constitution, and that's provoked a total crisis there because it was giving more power to the president. Now, supposedly the Arab Spring was about democracy, and now we see the lessenings of democracy. Megan brought up before what's happening in Libya, the decision of the Turks to the Turkish government to bring in the Patriot missiles into which NATO, I understand, has backed up. So the other paradigm is war and destruction of the nation state. Was there some discussion of how you bring about this dialogue of cultures? I mean, obviously people are going to go home to organize and to try and create new institutions, I guess, around the conference. But do you have a sense that people did leave the conference committed to this organizing process?
Yes. You see, what I've seen in the recent, probably 2 years, around about 2 years, is that Helga has, she writes an article for our weekly newspaper pretty much every week. So her article is the lead. It's usually the densest presentation of the strategic situation that you can find. Now, in the recent 2 years, she has turned more and more and more to clearly identifying empire. And we haven't always done that. Germany is a somewhat controlled, media controlled, what Helga calls the Käseglocke. I'm not exactly sure what that is in English, but a cover which is on the entire country, and certain Russians simply just can't have. It's not allowed. You'll be immediately attacked or just ignored ignored. So, but she's done that in a very, very precise way by showing that, of course, there's talk about democracy all the time, and especially from these weird Europeans. They're not really part of any nation, these people. They're Europeans who see the solution for everything in what they always call more Europe, whatever that means. I've looked at the map several times. It's not grown. She just identified how what they are showing, what they're talking about in terms of democracy, does not even apply in the country we live in. And you can ask pretty much anyone on the street. They may be poor or, have a high education or not. Doesn't matter. They will tell you or describe in their own words the same thing. They feel excluded. This is a kind of a party, like a party dictatorship. And if you don't go with the mainstream of the parties, then you won't be put up for re-election. So in other words, you have to have you have to do what's expected of you. You have to talk the talk that people want to hear from you. So there is none of that here anyway. And
I saw in the presentation from the Iranian ambassador a very good example of that, the use of irony to make a point. Here you have Susan Rice and Obama on behalf of the British insisting that we're going to go bomb countries and destroy nations and have regime change on behalf of democracy. And yet, who is the closest ally of the United States in doing this? You have the British, and then you have the Saudis. Where's the democracy in Saudi Arabia? Women aren't even allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia. And I thought that Obama was appealing for the women's vote.
yeah, exactly. So, at her opening keynote presentation at the conference, and in many discussions during and after the conference, she made very clear that we have to be aware there is such a thing as empire, which is, acting. It has a force. This is not something that, that we made up. It's real, and you see its effects. So it's in that in that sense, I would say it's a very serious discussion, because, as I said, we're not gathering to dream up projects and, I don't know, feel good about it, and then go home and ignore the situation the world is in. It's a very, you are aware that you're dealing with something that is very dangerous. We're talking about the possibility of nuclear war for more than a year now. This has been a focus of the organizers to prevent the outbreak of a nuclear or thermonuclear world war, which would very likely annihilate mankind. So this is not an easy thing. But the fact that we have that on the table and we're discussing it and discussing solutions that address that, I think that, yes, that definitely made it very, very real for people. Mm-hmm. And especially when they become, I can tell you, everyone who has been at this conference, and some people have said it, but I think everybody feels it was too small. I think there were just around 300, about 300 people there, and it should be 3,000. And I think people will do a lot to make that possible for the next conference.
Well, Megan, one of the things that struck me from what Stefan just said is that the beginning of the change is by speaking the truth. It's knowing the truth, having the authority to forecast and do forecasts based on truthful analysis the way Mr. LaRouche does. But the second point is this question of irony, how irony works in culture and how it also works in science. And you've done a lot of work on Kepler. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, because I know in these weekly reports you've been discussing this with Jason, with Ben, and with Mr. LaRouche, and you've had a lot to say in terms of how this works in music and how the creative process in music is the same process as that in scientific discovery. And actually, that same process of discovery of universal principles has to be at the basis of statecraft. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Actually, it's funny you brought that up. I was just thinking that when Stefan was discussing the different presentations and the presentation about the program for the desert in Nawapa, because when you're dealing with human action on the planet, in the universe, which includes human culture, human statecraft, human science, what we're dealing with at the core of all of these things is real creativity. It's the ability to bring something into being which didn't exist before, not just in some kind of, fantastical way, but in a way which is valid. And to make that a little more specific, you look at the process of science. You brought up Kepler. Kepler discovered universal gravitation. It was not Isaac Newton. It had nothing to do with fruit falling from a tree. The discovery of universal gravitation was made by Johannes Kepler in the end of the 1500s, the beginning of the 1600s. And the way that Kepler discovered gravitation was not by finding it within the data of his observations or within the mathematical formulas of his calculations. And if you look at his work in discovering the fact that the orbits of the planets were not circular, they were elliptical, which is not something anybody's ever seen, but it's been proven to be true. Kepler was using the same data and the same tools of geometry and arithmetic and so forth as all of his predecessors. And yet he was able to make the discovery where nobody else was. Now, the way that he did that was through a process of recreation. And I want to put it that way because that's the same process that a classical musician has to go through when they're performing a piece of classical music. The musician and the scientist alike have to recreate the original composition as an act of their own creativity. And so what Kepler did is he was able to imagine, he was able to come across the discrepancies in the data where the data and the calculations just didn't add up. And he was able then to make a leap of the mind to imagine imagine a principle of the universe, which was a conception in the mind of the creator, which would have caused all of the different motions of the planets, which could have caused all these different seemingly contradictory sense readings and instrument readings. He imagines the principle which is unseen, and unfolds it from there and imagines, if I'm the creator and if these are the my conceptions, my principles, how would I then create the physical universe to be a reflection of this? It's the same with classical music. You take the process of a string quartet, which is working together to perform Mozart, Beethoven. The process of the string quartet is exactly that. Starts from the score, from the piece of paper with the notes, but that's not the music. The music has to come about through a living process of recreation. And you see the best string quartets work on this. They work at it, and they do it again, and they do it again, and you have a certain locking in to the original idea of the composer. And so it's absolutely the same quality of mind, which is typical of the human species. Creativity, the ability to access ideas and conceptions which are completely inaccessible to your simple sense perception or some kind of simple statement of an idea. And then you look at the political situation today, and that's precisely what our survival depends on. It depends on the ability for people to conceive of a state of mankind which does not exist in anything around them.
You know, this gets back to the earlier question I asked you of how do you know the natural impulse of the human being is creativity? You look through the work of someone like Kepler or the work of Bach, and you see that there's no way it could have been produced other than this creative discovery of something new. And that's something which comes from the individual human mind. But here's my follow-up question to that. How do we go about convincing people that they are, in fact, human in that way, as opposed to people who are pragmatic, or even worse, pragmatism actually comes from being people of the senses who believe that you can only see or know what you see or hear, and in fact, look for sensual gratification from music, from whatever they're doing, as opposed to those higher faculties. So I'd like to hear from both of you. Why don't we start with you, Megan? How do you communicate to people that they are human and they therefore are creative?
Well, I think the best way is to put them through it, in a sense. And I'll just reference again the effect of a great performance, or even just, you know, nowadays, even just a truthful, even if it's not perfect, a truthful performance of a piece of classical music, which is beautiful. And we've seen this. I've spent a lot of time organizing in the Boston local, where we have the core of the organizing local up there is a chorus. And so a lot of the outreach that we're able to do in our street organizing around the policy interventions of Mr. LaRouche is done with a chorus singing classical music in the streets. And I've seen this in the streets, and I've seen this at political events that we've held as well. The effect of the performance of a piece of classical music, which is beautiful, shocks people. And the kinds of discussions that we're able to have with people after they've been through that experience, where something's touched their soul, are of a completely different quality than beforehand. And it's a little bit hard to answer your question, because we are just really discussing a real transformation of the human soul, where all of a sudden the person's open to thinking thoughts that they weren't before. So maybe we can start with that and get at it.
Well, I think that's what you, Stefan, were describing from the response to the Saturday night concert at the Schiller Conference.
Yes. Yeah. I just I thought that people like Mozart, Beethoven, they were probably also in their own way organizers, but they didn't just organize one-on-one. I mean, Mozart wrote operas, symphonies, and so did Beethoven, and that is the work of actually creating a different kind of effect, something that is, some people have that ability to have such an effect on an audience when they speak. I would say that Mr. LaRouche certainly did that. I've heard a couple of presentations that were very, very much very touching, also from you, Harley, and we just had Mike Billington here, who moved people a lot. But this music is a different thing, and I completely agree with Megan, because we have the experience here. You know, there are certain little musical jokes that Beethoven wrote. These are small canons. They're relatively easy to learn and easy to sing. You know, and they're always fun to do to present out in the streets. But I also know, whenever we presented, for instance, Mozart's Ave Verum, or other like or the final movement of the Ninth Symphony, the effect is completely different. It is completely different, and it's hard to describe. But one instance we had with that that was very similar to this conference, but was yet clearer, at least for me, because it was the first time that I saw something like this. Was the first presentation we did about 2 years ago, I think, of the fourth movement of the Ninth Symphony. You know, in a room that has the usual political well, I would say usual political audience, meaning that people sit there, often they don't know one another, it's rather quiet, and they're waiting for things to start. Then there are a lot of presentations, it was a Schiller Fest that we had done then in late 2009. And then we presented this piece. I don't think it was anywhere perfect, but afterwards, the whole room, and it was similar now at the conference, just exploded. People were just, you know, like Megan described, they're changed. And all of a sudden they're talking, you know, it's very, very loud. And something changed the state that they were in entirely.
This is the principle that Schiller discusses when he talks about how someone goes into a theater and comes out of it afterwards as a different person, an improved, a changed person. With classical drama, I think similarly what you're talking about, special pieces like the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, or for me, the Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, where you have a very hilarious procession of events, but underneath it is this profound yearning for something more real in life, justice, equality, a certain principle of human love. And it comes together and you end up literally floating out of the theater if it's done properly. And I think this is something that has been denied to people. When both of you spoke about the oligarchical principle, one of the keys to that is to remove that from people's lives, either to make classical music so sterile that only very wealthy patrons will go to it to be seen, or to eliminate it altogether. And I think this is an important point. The idea, and I know in your campaign, Stefan, and what Megan was talking about with Rachel Brown's campaigns in Boston, the chorus actually transformed street corners.
Yeah. I would actually add that something that we've taken up in the last couple of years are these Musikabende, musical evenings that we often do in the office. So you know, you don't necessarily need a fancy place, even though it would be nice to have a place with better acoustics. But where you know the members here. And sometimes guests that we invite, because we do meet musicians, we do meet actors, poets sometimes. I mean, you meet people, and then you come here and present poems, lieder, arias, you know, little things. Sometimes the duet. Last time we also did the Gefangenenchor, the prisoner's chorus from Fidelio.
Right.
And, you know, the fact that it's so close. It's not like, you know, you don't even have the distance that you have in a concert hall where you have to buy a ticket and then you have to, you know, put your clothes in the, hand it out in the wardrobe and then you go in and you have to be quiet and you are here and the musicians are sitting down there on that, you know, in the light on the stage. But it's very close. It's very subjective for everyone because, you know, all of a sudden you meet the person that has organized you, that is telling you about nuclear war, and about development projects, and all of a sudden that same person stands there reciting a poem or singing a beautiful song. And it has that same kind of quality that Helga often calls a bath for the soul. You know,
I think this is also really important for the work that's coming out on the weekly report, because Lynn has made the point repeatedly that when you deal with great scientists, and the two examples he uses are Einstein and Max Planck, these were people who participated in precisely the kind of Musikabends that Stefan was just describing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I was just thinking of the example of Percy Shelley, who spent time when he was just beginning as a student studying science, and he was completely fascinated with electricity and the different discoveries that were being made. And then you had somebody like Kepler, who was absolutely provoked by the new development in human music, which was polyphony, the ability of many voices singing different lines in counterpoint with each other, singing together. And Kepler was completely fascinated by polyphony and the implications of polyphony for, you know, human concepts and the development of civilization. And it's so, Stefan, what you're raising, it's absolutely true that this is a shocking thing for people today to see the person that was fighting with them on the impeachment of Obama singing a classical duet. But it's only strange because of what's been done to the culture today. That actually is the most natural condition of human society, and hardly what you brought up. You see it in the best scientists, Planck, Einstein, Kepler, and so on.
You see it in someone like Benjamin Franklin, who invented a musical instrument that Mozart composed for, the glass harmonica.
Mm-hmm. And wrote a string quartet.
Yes, so it's clear that this question then of the cultural intervention, making it subjective, I know this is something that is the mission of, in particular, Helga, and Stefan, you've been working very closely with her, this idea of that people can change. You know, we always talk to people who say, well, I'm old, I can't change, or these days it's, people don't want to change. But you actually can reach people. I know you've seen it, not just at this conference, but I believe in several other conferences recently where Helga did an intervention.
You know, I'm trying to think about, you know, in organizing conversations or any kind of talk, especially when you're you know, in a difficult situation where it's not so easy to speak openly and whatnot. So it's always a bit tricky to get through, you know, the various masks that people wear, various opinions, whatever perceptions or impressions they have of you in that same moment. And I was just thinking about still that these, the question of music and beauty in general, but music is probably the most direct in terms of beautiful arts, is so important, because when we tell people, I mean, if you say to someone, we need a classical renaissance, we need classical music, and sometimes they just look at you and say, what do you want? I mean, there's the shopping malls are full of CDs and DVDs, and there's the internet, you can download whatever you, I mean, there's millions of things. But the point is that what we're doing there is something that is alive, you know, it's real and very intimate, which never happens, you know, with a CD. I mean, I've never, you know, it may be impressive, but it's not, it usually doesn't reach that quality of intimacy that makes you open up.
You see, I think the question you just posed actually gets beyond what most people think of as beautiful, because most people think beautiful is a tune that they like, that moves them, that makes them feel happy or something. And I was thinking about the question of tragedy, because tragedy is a central part of classical culture. And often what happens in a tragedy is not beautiful. You take the case of Macbeth, which is about as bloody a drama as you can have. Well, where's the beauty in it? And I think this is interesting. Lincoln's favorite play was Macbeth, and he used Macbeth to organize his cabinet around this principle of having to take responsibility. Now, who is it who's taking responsibility in Macbeth? It's the dramatist. It's the playwright. It's Shakespeare. You know, so was Lincoln identifying with Macbeth or Macduff or Banquo or one of those characters? No, he identified with the composer. And that goes back to what you were saying earlier, Megan, about the role of the musician to incorporate and make their own the creative process of a composer.
Yeah, and I think also what you're just bringing up, the closeness that Lincoln could feel to Shakespeare, that kind of intimacy with somebody who's dead and gone, that's the same quality that the scientist has to feel when they're, you know, diving deep into their own soul to discover the principles of the universe. And I think it shows that what we're really getting at in this discussion is not the don't, you know, music and having X number of classical concerts per year, but the point is we're discussing a quality of the human mind, which is absolutely denied by the oligarchical system, and that's why we're in this mess today. And I think it's pretty clear that we can actually access this and bring this out of the population. People can actually feel human again, and we see it.
Well, let me bring this back then to the immediate organizing situation. Stefan, what you're dealing with in Europe is that there was another failed heads of state meeting last week. There's another phony agreement on the Greek debt. And meanwhile, people are killing themselves in Greece and in Spain. Youth unemployment is now over 50% in Greece and Spain. The European Union as a whole is now at negative growth, so it's approaching what's technically called a recession. Yet we still see, as you said earlier, people saying we need more Europe, meaning more of these bureaucratic institutions that are literally banker dictatorships and no national sovereignty. What do you see? Do you see the potential to break out of this in Europe, or is it only going to come after something happens in the United States? And clearly you're going to continue to fight, but how do you see this thing unfolding now?
It's hard to say, because really, unlike some years ago, things are changing very quickly, and something that you hear in the morning may sometimes is outdated in the evening. I mean, take for instance the EFSF and the ESM were just downgraded in their credit rating because of the downgrading of France, and there's a lot of hoopla about that, but I mean, it is to be expected. So Helga's take, when we discussed just in the last couple of days on this, is that this is unfolding so fast that it's really hard to tell how long the euro can be maintained, and all this talk about Europe. And just as a personal observation from a lot of these events that I went to, it took me a while to figure out that what these people are talking, this is a form of newspeak. And I specifically asked people that I met at some of these conferences about, am I the only one that's sitting here that doesn't understand a word of what they're saying? Because they're using this. No, you have to understand.
I've been at some of those conferences where I heard Barroso talk about more Europe, more Europe. And I turned to someone and I said, where are you going to get more Europe? And the person looked at me and then said, I don't know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
He was agreeing a minute before.
Yeah, yeah, and part of it is that the British, I have to say, in this whole European mess, I mean, they're the only ones that are native English speakers. So you get this garbled English from all the other, you know, the Polish, the French, the Germans, who all seemingly use their, you know, their own language's grammar and then put English words to it. That's difficult enough to listen to, but it has no content. And I asked, especially foreigners, I asked people from Russia, and just said, look, does that make sense to you? And then, you know, you get an indication that they're all used to it. This is kind of a game that's being played, and, you know, they give their speeches and so forth. But, no, I think I'm actually I'm somewhat carefully optimistic, and only for the reason that, it is pretty bad. And I don't expect, as I've discovered many years ago, I don't expect that faced with a terrible crisis, people automatically turn to a solution. In fact, a lot of people go crazy and they do all kinds of crazy things. But there are people who are waiting for what we have to offer. I mean that literally, because you realize that once you've met them, they get to know you. You know, it's a bit of a process, and it's not always easy. But you find that there are, you know, the pearls out there in that vast ocean of idiocy, and these people can act. And with this conference, we brought a lot of them together, and we just need to find more. And it's a tough task, but it's fun, and I think it's possible. I really think it's possible. Obviously, with the United States, it would be fantastic.
Well, let me just ask Megan, because Megan, you were in a meeting with Mr. LaRouche this morning. He did another one of his Friday Project webcasts last night. He talked a lot about this problem of the dumbing down of Americans, the drug problem. Was there anything that he said in particular that you think would be useful to communicate to our listening audience?
Yeah, I mean, one thing he said is what people know but might not really want to think through, which is that what we're dealing with today is an extremely dumbed down population because of decades of attack on the human mind and the replacement of it with the entertainment culture, the now culture, the, you know, feel it culture. So we do have that problem where in previous times the population would have responded much more quickly to the solutions we're presenting. So you have that obstacle. The other thing he said this morning and also a couple days ago gets back to this question of classical composition. When you're dealing with a political fight like this, you have to think like the general of an army, or you have to think like a poet, and you have to flank the situation, you have to surprise the population. So what we're about to do on the LaRouche Pack website and also more widely, we're about to release a paper written by Michael Kirsch on the treason of the Andrew Jackson administration and the takedown of the US credit system, which makes the case clearly, very clearly makes the case that the issue today and the failure of the United States Congress and the United States institutions to break from the economics of the Wall Street-based, you know, London-based empire, that goes all the way back to the fraud that was imposed with Andrew Jackson. And the case that's made there can actually shock people into letting go of those axioms, because you realize, what the person who reads it should realize, what I realized is, oh my gosh, everything I was taught to think about economics goes back to this British treason with Andrew Jackson. That's not American. And so what we're about to do in the United States and more broadly is get this paper to these people who are on the edge of making a shift in the United States Congress. We're going to get it to the more thinking people, and we're going to get it out also widely in the population and actually force this issue that this is British treason, it's been British treason, and demonstrate what the real American system is.
Well, and this gets back to what Stefan said Helga has been focusing on, which is that we're facing a real empire, and if you don't destroy the empire, you're not going to survive.
Right.
That's right.
Well, we're almost out of time. I just, Stefan, you mentioned again that people should be looking for an upcoming conference. Anything more you can say about it besides the ongoing organizing process?
Well, I'm not sure about. I'm not aware of any details yet. But for sure, we will get this website up. I mean, if there are any listeners here from Germany, then they should consider increasing their contribution or starting to contribute, so we can do this faster. Because we just need funds for it also.
And which website should any German-speaking Americans or other listeners who speak German, where should they go to get your daily reports?
Well, there's two things for now. I think one is the Schiller Institute website, Schiller. Institute without an E in the end, .de. But you can also Google it. It's easy to find because that has all the conference proceedings. I think we're still uploading some of the videos because with all the languages, German, English.
Do you have the concert
Italian,
up yet?
I actually don't know.
Okay.
You know, our webmaster here tells me that these are 184 videos to render, so that's a lot to do. I'm not sure what is done and what not, but it's all going to be there. A lot of it is already there. You can see the Iranian ambassador, Helga, Hussein Askari, and that's going to be there. As soon as we have it, we're also going to show the conference dedicated website, definitely on this place. And we will also feature that on our own Bürgerrechtsbewegung Solidarität webpage, which is BUESO.de, BUESO.de.
Okay, and our listeners also should know that Lyndon LaRouche will be continuing his Friday night webcast, The Friday Project. I think this is his contribution to ending the dumbing down and actually finding people who can think and move them into action. So I thank both of you for a very fascinating and provocative discussion today. I think our listeners will appreciate it, and hopefully those of you who are not yet familiar with the work that's been done on classical culture on both sides of the Atlantic by the Schiller Institute can go to the two websites. There's a SchillerInstitute.com website in the United States as well. So, Stefan and Megan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Harley.
Thank you, Harley. Have a good evening.
And this has been another broadcast of the LaRouche Show on LaRouchePub.com. And we invite you to come back next week and every Saturday at 3 p.m. To hear the LaRouche Show. Thank you very much, and goodbye. Thank you.